Welcome everyone to episode 14 of the Golden Arrow series, looking back at the BDO World Championship. And today I'm joined by the seven-time major runner-up and stalwart of the BDO scene, the silverback himself, Mr. Tony O'Shea. How are you, Tony?
I'm pretty good, mate. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. How's the lockdown been for you?
To be honest, obviously it was hectic leading up to it, and so far I've actually enjoyed the downtime, to be honest. I'm a bit of a home person. I'm a natural couch potato, so yeah, I've actually enjoyed it, to be honest.
And you have played a bit of darts. You were part of both of the remote darts league competitions. How did you enjoy those?
Yeah, it was a bit different, obviously, but such a pleasure playing from home, to be honest. I've got a nice little setup here, so literally I'm just stepping from my lounge into my dart room and bang, you're ready to go. Obviously, as most dart players will tell you, sometimes it's a pain getting ready, going out and getting to a venue and everything that leads up to it can be a bit of a pain. But yeah, I really enjoyed both of them events. Yeah, really enjoyed it.
Will it feel a little bit strange then, going back into a venue when things were up and running properly?
Yeah, like I said, I've enjoyed this lockdown, but yeah, I do miss the crack with the lads. I mean, during a normal season, I see a lot more of Daryl and Robbo and the guys than I do with the wife. So I've actually missed that camaraderie and the crack we have there. And it is going to be strange, obviously, mixing with so many people. It'll probably take a good while yet for it to get back to what we call normal. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. But like I say, more the banter than anything else.
And looking at your darting career, I know you had a couple of deep runs at the Welsh Open in the late 90s. But when did you actually start playing darts?
It would have been very late 70s. Actually, it's hard to believe now, but I was only about 10 stone. I played football in them days. And one of the ways we used to fundraise was actually playing Killy, you know, the whole squad. There was about 20 or 30 of us. And that was the first time I really picked a dart up in a pub. And doing about 78 after football matches. But I must have been quite good at Killer, because I used to win most of the games. And the way we did it, whoever won the game of darts, all the money the lads had put in went towards a meat raffle, and obviously I was winning meat raffles every week. So that's how the landlord sort of spotted me playing just Killer. So it went from there, and I joined his team, and then it all began then, like I say, about 78 or something like that.
Going from then to when you made your BDO World Championship debut in 2002, what was the journey like in those years?
I mean, obviously, I think we've all done the same thing. We started off at local pub level, then you represent your town Super League, then counties, and then internationals. And it's amazing how many times it follows that when you get picked for England, after all the hard work, that you usually sort of tend to get your visits to the Lakesides, and that's exactly what happened with me. I went through all the same system, and that took a long time. But I never had a sponsor in the early days, so I couldn't really afford to go to world-ranking events. It was the places like Pontins on holiday camps, you know, the Welsh Open, the England Open, things like that. And obviously, they used to stretch out for a week then. That was our main holiday of the year, going to Pontins. So, yeah, it's quite a long road, but it's one that most our players go down.
When in 2002 you did play at the Lakeside, how was it that you actually qualified for the event?
Well, I was saying there about going through the system we have, through various avenues. I played in about 10, maybe more, qualifiers, you know, to actually be one of the qualifiers, and never managed it. But sort of the second full year I went on the World Tour, I qualified by right through points. So it just shows how tough it is to play against county players when I never made it. But I go on the World Tour and crash bang wallop. I do it within sort of 18 months. So, never made it through the qualifiers themselves, but crashed through quite successfully. And when I started travelling the world, it just cost a lot more money to do it, that's all.
And that year you lost 3-2 in the first round to Colin Monk. What are your memories of that game and the first time that you were playing in the World Championship?
I remember it was a really close game. It wasn't the best average-wise. I think it was only mid-80s or something. But obviously it went to a last leg sudden shootout. Now, I don't care who you are, they're fun. maybe not to play as much, but to watch, definitely. And I just remember going there thinking, this might be my one and only time here. I mean, you never know. So I think the prize money was $2,750, and I stayed the whole week. Me and Jill stayed the whole week, and we watched every game and tried getting on telly, you know, and sat with the players and that. And yeah, I blew every penny I'd won. So just in case it was my one and only, I made sure I was going to enjoy it, and I certainly did.
Later that year, you got to your first major final at the inaugural World Darts Trophy in the Netherlands. You didn't win it, but how important was it to beat the players you beat and reach your first major final mentally?
Well, to do it that quickly in my career, really, getting to a major final. I mean, it was a brand new tournament. It was the inaugural World Trophy in Holland. And obviously, I was doing well in the rankings, so I qualified for it. But the one thing that sort of set me up was beating Barneveld in the semis. I mean, again, it was a brilliant match. It was a close match, but, you know, I played pretty decent. And that certainly put me on the map in Holland and paved the way for quite a bit of exhibition work in them early 2000s. And obviously the points I got from that just shot me up the rankings again, and that started off a pretty good 10-year run from there on. So yeah, it was brilliant, and that was the first time we'd been spoiled as celebrities, because darts in Holland by then was, thanks to Barneveld, was massive. So I became an overnight star in Holland, and yeah, I made the most of that for a few years.
2003, you were back at the Lakeside. You beat Ted Hankey in the first round before again going down 3-2 to Colin Monk. But how relieved were you to beat Ted and get your first win on the Lakeside stage?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think your first ever appearance there is a massive milestone, and I'd done it the year before, but then that's all I thought about was just get a win under your belt. And at the time, Ted was playing awesome darts, and yeah, it was a tough draw, but I did play well, and I managed to beat Ted. But then, obviously, Colin wasn't in the mood for sentiment, and I think again it was another a very close game. It could have been a tiebreaker again. I think he went to the last set, but yeah. But Colin was a tough player in them days. You know, he'd won the World Masters not long before, and yeah, he was playing well. So again, there's no such thing as an easy game. But I was just really glad to get a win under my belt, and then you feel you're up and running. Then and you deserve to be there, sort of thing. Yeah.
And later that year, you won your first BDO singles event at the Swiss Open. That must have been quite a special moment for you.
Yeah, I've been close a few times. I've lost in a lot of finals on the tour and various Opens. I've won a few of them, but again, that Swiss Open, I had a nice victory against Barneveld, I think it was the last 16. So, you know, I was proving to myself I could actually beat the best players, compete with them, beat them, and I think, I can't remember, it was Tony Westerbeek in the final. But yeah, I was really chuffed with that, winning that first world ranking event. And again, it was still early doors in my career, really. That was 2003. I've been to a few finals, but like I said, it's only sort of three or four years actually on the main tour. And yeah, to have done so well, and I started playing for England then as well. So yeah, everything at that time was going brilliant.
Yeah, and I mean, the next year you really sort of stamped your foot down at the World Championship, got to the semi-finals after some really good wins. How much did that boost your confidence, as you say, beating some more of the top players and showing that you were a real threat?
Well, I always treat myself as the underdog, you know what I mean? Because I knew I weren't the best player in the world, nowhere near, but I was doing well with what I had in the army, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, to keep winning and beating good players and progressing in tournaments, and like I said, to get to a semi-final, you know, only I think it was my third go. So, yeah, that was just amazing. I mean, obviously, I think that was the year that Andy had won it, and I came quite friendly with Andy Fordham in them days. And yeah, for to get to the semis, I think I'd have played Andy in the final if I'd got through. That would have been special, because obviously I was rooming with him for England at the time, and yeah, that would have been brilliant. But yeah, I fell in the semis, but I counted that as a big success at the time, and Andy winning it, so I capped it off a bit for me.
And later that year, you actually reached your second major final, and 2004 World Championship, you lost to Merv King, and again, Merv beat you in the World Masters 7-6 in what was an incredibly high quality final. How tough a defeat was that to take?
I think, you know, if he'd just strolled away and won it easily and played brilliant like he usually did in them days, I wouldn't have had a problem. But I think that was probably the first real match where I was upset with myself, because I was 5-3 and 6-4 up in a race to 7. Now, I do remember that them last few sets, he was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think Mr. Nine Down in one of them, So I didn't really do anything wrong, but to get in a position where you're so close to winning it, I mean, I don't think I did anything wrong. I mean, a few people online said I bottled it, but I think if you look at the figures, Merv was absolutely brilliant them last few sets. So, yeah, that was probably the first time I remember being upset with losing. And yeah, but obviously I got used to it over the next few years anyway, so it wasn't a problem.
And Merv's obviously notoriously one of the game's big practices. Were you someone who liked to spend hours on the practice board, or was it just a case of you were playing so regularly, it kind of games were practice?
Well, probably then from 2000 onwards, I was playing a couple of times during the week locally and obviously 3 or 4 days of the weekend in comp. So for me, that was more than enough. I've never been a big practicer. I mean, my good pal Daryl Fitton's always telling people, you know, if I practiced, I'd probably be better. But I always felt I got stale quickly if I played too much. And so I suppose over the years, I've never been the biggest practicer. But yeah, it works for some people. And obviously, as you said, Merv's just phenomenal on the practice board. And maybe, you know, other players are different. I think if you look at Gary Anderson now, he hardly ever throws. Can you imagine how good he'd be if he played 6 hours a day? But yeah, everyone's different now. But it worked for me for quite a long spell, so I was happy the way I played my game anyway.
And talking to Merv King, it was the same story again in 2005. You got to a major final, the International Darts League, and once again he was the bogeyman who beat you.
Yeah, I think it was the World Masters format, best of three legs to a set, and I think he won 13-11 or something like that set. So it was a good game, a long game, and a tough game. And obviously, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I was doing really well. I was getting beat by quality class players. I wasn't losing, you know, to nobodies. I mean, you're somebody if you make a TV event anyway. But I was losing to class quality players who actually played well at the time. I mean, I think the standards have gone up a bit these days, but, you know, at the time I was losing to good players, so it didn't really bother me losing the finals. I was thinking, I'm getting to them, there's players who'd kill for my positions in the event, so yeah, it didn't really bother me that much.
Talking of the International Darts League, 2 years later, I know it was the last one, there was quite a lot of controversy behind the scenes, but a big proud moment, I'm sure, in that tournament for you was when you hit the 9-darter against Adrian Lewis.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd known Eddie since he was a young kid playing in Cheshire. I actually played with his dad, Sammy Wright, for a long time. I think he only played once for England, so he's from good stock, and we always knew, even well before that he was going to be a world-class player. I mean, he's proved it since, but, I mean, I watched the video not too long ago, to be honest. Somebody asked to put it on, so I put it on my phone for him, and I was giggling how young Eddie looked. I mean, it was 13 years ago, but he's still a kid now, do you know what I mean? So, but yeah, I was playing well at the time, and I can't remember where I finished in the tournament that week, but I think Phil Taylor had hit one the night before. I hit one the night after, which was the Wednesday, which is also my 9th of May, which is also my 46th birthday as well, and my grandson's birthday. So yeah, it was a special day. That, I mean, I don't think there's many players who... You've got a grandson born the same day as hitting a 9-dar on their birthday. You know what I mean? That's a great trivia question for the future. That. So, yeah, it was awesome. There's no feeling like hitting that 9-dar.
And you always fared quite well in those sort of mixed PDC-BDO competitions because you topped your group twice, I think it was, in the Grand Slam as well.
Yeah, it's obviously, I was mixing it with the best then. That was... So 2009, around my era, I think I played in about 5 or 6. But when you're playing against the cream, it makes you play better. I don't know whether it's a fear of looking silly, but I think the year I got to the quarterfinal, it might be the first year. I think Phil beat me in the last 68, sorry, in the last 8, and I averaged, if I remember right, 102 or something like that. Phil was just awesome. I think I took more legs than anybody else against him in that tournament. I think I picked 7 up in the quarter final against him, and that was probably as good as I'll ever be able to play, you know, in a tournament, and it wasn't nowhere near good enough. That's how good Phil Taylor is. So, but I'm not the first one to get home by him, and probably still won't be the last now.
Looking 2008, towards the end of 2008, you got to the semis of the World Masters and the semis of the Zuiderdam Masters in Holland. That... Mm-hmm. Those two big tournaments towards the end of the year, must have been perfect preparation for you going into the World Championships, because you knew, you know, I'm playing good stuff.
Well, if I'm honest, I mean, I think for about 5 years, I felt like that. Every tournament I was going in, I mean, I thought I was going to win it, because I never said it outright, because like I say, I like to class myself as the underdog. Whether that's just an emotional thing with me, just to try to keep me calm or whatever. But I felt good everywhere I went. I mean, I had a couple of nine darts in other events, and, you know, I was playing really well. I think 2009, I won something like 9 events that year, and I was the BDO world number one, I was the WDF number one at the start of 2010. So around that era, that was probably me at my best. So, I always fancied winning tournaments.
And 2009, you got to your first BDO World Championship final. I mean, you had some great wins to get there. But, of course, the big one to get to the final was you beat your best mate, Daryl Fitton, in the semis. How, I mean, what was that game like? Because, obviously, you two are so close. So, you know, either of you would have been playing in your first World Final.
Yeah, of course. It was, I mean, your first time at the Lakeside's big, your first time playing for England's big. I mean, we've both been there. And to get to your first World Final, obviously I was going to stop him or he's going to stop me, which we never really spoke about it, but obviously it was in the back of our minds. But I mean, and if you watch the game all the way through, I mean, we were messing about at times as well. He pushed me a couple of times. And you know, we treated the game, it was just a game between me and him. And we tried putting the rest of it behind us, because then you'd start thinking too much. So, but yeah, we enjoyed it. And I think when I hit that bullseye at the end, I covered my face up, if I remember. I couldn't look at him for a split second, because I could just, even then, I could just imagine how he was feeling. I know how I'd have felt at the same time. So, that was a tough game. I don't think I've had one like that ever since. So, yeah, that's really tough, that game. But the reward was there, so it had to be done, sort of thing.
You went into that final with Ted Hankey. Going into your first one, what were the nerves like? How did you sleep the night before?
My first final, obviously, I was so excited. I don't think I slept much anyway. Because, again, I fancied it. I mean, I think I beat Ted in the World Masters a couple of months before it. I beat him in a TV event just before Christmas. So I was the form player out of the two of us, you know, in head-to-heads. And even though the bookies had Ted as favourite, because of him, he's won it once before, and he was quality. It was my first one, so Ted was the favourite, but I thought the bookies had got it wrong. But anyway, you never see a poor bookie, they got it right, didn't they? So.
What was that final like when it was 6-6 and you were going into that final set? Did you feel confident that you were going to get over the line?
Well, I mean, Ted had missed a lot of doubles earlier in the match. I mean, you know, he dominated the game, to be honest, and he could have won it a couple of times before he actually did. And I just kept thinking to myself, well, maybe it's for a reason. You know, he keeps giving me chances, I kept taking them. But I made a rookie mistake at the start of the last set. I mean, I was so hot. I'm a big lad anyway, and I do sweat when it's cold. But I should have just took a step back and gone back to the table and just took a minute or two, because I cracked on with it and sweat was dripping on my hands. I think I kicked off with 30 or something stupid like that, and that was purely down to dripping on my darts and little things like that. I mean, all these years later, and that's the first thing I think about for that final. I should have stopped, you know, for the last set. But that noise, you know, they were singing just before we did start again. When I brought it back to 6-6, you could feel the singing, not hear it. It's, I've never felt a noise like it at darts, and that's one of the memories that'll always be moving. It was brilliant.
I remember it was an incredible spectacle to watch, and I remember Tony Green at the time said that for him it was the best final since 1992, with obviously, you know, Mike Gregor and Phil Taylor. So,
yeah.
I mean, that game, looking back, obviously, tinged with disappointment, but is it proud that you were part of such an iconic game?
Oh, of course, yeah, because I think you hit it on the nail there. I mean, again, it wasn't the best averages, you know, but I think it's probably up there for the excitement and the thrill and the crowd noise. I mean, I still haven't heard a better one to this day. And even though I won the right result, obviously I'm so proud of all the finals. You know, I mean, it's as I said, there's people who would kill for my record. And when I do retire, I'll retire a happy man.
And I know Ted did an interview recently, and he said that you know, at that time he was actually thinking about giving up darts and walking away. And he said it was actually you, Daryl Fitton and Gary Robson who sort of chivied him along and helped him kind of rediscover his mojo. What was your relationship like with Ted?
Well, I think he's probably nailed it there. I mean, but it's not just Ted. We're a family, the darts family. And there's a few times people have gone through bad times, and we've all helped each other out, whether it's mentally, financially, or whatever. There's lots of things. I mean, I see Daryl and Rob, I'll just pick them two out. I see them probably 30, 35 weekends of the year. And it is a family. And I know that's the BVO way, it always has been. I know it's gone by the wayside now, and I think we've lost that side. But over the years, it has been a family, and we used to say the BDO family. And the PDC, you know, they're all ex-BDO players anyway. They're all good lads, but the money they're playing for now, they've got to be so much more professional. And I get that, but I'm old school. I should have been born 10 years earlier and played with Jockey and Alan Evans and all them lot. But yeah, it's a different game now. But as I said, you know, we're a family and we do still look after each other, even these days.
Later that year, 2009, you did get a major title. You won the World Cup singles playing for England. That must have been a hugely proud moment for you.
Well, that's one of the... We had a great trip to Charlotte in Carolina. Myself, Daryl's in the team as well. And we went over there... And we won it, and me winning the singles on the last game of the tournament actually secured the win. So you know, to do that, and that was just, what an amazing year that was, 09 for me. Like I say, I won about 8 or 9 events altogether and got to my first final, won my first major. So, yeah, that's my best ever year. And I've got, I'm sat here in my diary room, I'm looking at pictures from it now, you know what I mean? And it's, yeah, it was special. But we had a fun time out there as well. And you've got to enjoy the darts now. I mean, I've been to a couple of the challenge tours with PDC, and it's so different to what I remember. And I do miss them days when we used to travel and have a laugh. I mean, obviously, me and Daryl went to Las Vegas for a fortnight to play in that a few years ago, and we had a ball out there. Do you know what I mean? And I don't see that happening with modern darts. It's just so professional now. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because that's why the big sponsors and the big TVs involved. And so yeah, but as I said, I'm old school.
You won 5 titles while playing for England. You won the pairs a couple of times. You won singles, and obviously you won the team event a couple of times. Where does playing for England, playing for your country, rank among your career highlights?
Well, obviously, as a lad starting out to play darts, and my big ambition was to play for Stockport in the Manchester Super League at the time. And when I achieved that, I thought, wow, this is mint now. So I move on 10 years and it's times 100, just getting picked for your country. I think whatever your sport is, it needs to highlight your career. And then I actually went on to captain the country a few years later. So, do you know what I mean? I just couldn't have... If I'd have written a little plan out for myself for my career... Everything's ticked apart from being the world champion, but everything else is on there. So playing for my country was amazing.
And 2010, you went into the World Championship after an incredible year. You went in as the number one seed. Did that add any pressure for you, or did you relish that?
Well, at the time, I mean, obviously, I'd only just won the World Cup singles in America, and I think I won another tournament just after that. So I think it was in Turkey or somewhere like that. So I was absolutely buzzing, and I mean, I never get overconfident for anything. As I said, I always think as the underdog, but so many times you go in as the world number one or the number one seed, which I did, and I think it was young Smithy who clobbered me 3-1 in that event, and it sort of just brings you down to earth a little bit. But I never get carried away, things like that. I mean, it was only the one year where I was world number one and number one seed anyway, and you know, I played well for a lot of years, so it just shows how tough it is to get to that position. But obviously, once I've lost in the first round of that, you can just relax and get on with everything else then. So, it was still exciting. I still stayed for the whole week, and I think I've done it every single year I've played. I don't think I've gone home once, to be honest.
In 2012, obviously, was your second final, but I know you said at the time you credited that you'd employed a mind coach to help you. Why did you bring Stephen on board?
Gary Robson had used him for a couple of things, and And obviously, late 2011, I don't think I was struggling mentally, but I thought, well, you know, you hear a lot about other sportsmen doing it now, and Robbo praised him, so I thought, I'll give it a go. And I went over to Belfast a couple of days early for the Northern Ireland Open, and I had a session with him, and I literally won the Northern Ireland Open that weekend. I think I lost two legs the whole weekend. And again, it's just more of a confidence boost, but obviously people who are just starting out, and if they're a bit worried, I think it's something that a lot of players should look at. And obviously, after I'd done it, and even though it didn't help me win the world title, he certainly helped Glenn Durren, he's helped Ross Montgomery to win big events, and he's helped Scott Mitchell quite a lot, who went on to become world champion. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said for the mental side of the game. And for them first 12 months, it helped me because I picked up quite a few titles not long after I'd seen Stephen. So I think it came a couple of years later to the Lakeside. I had a session at the Lakeside. And again, you know, I got to two semi-finals on the trot. So, yeah, it's... two more finals on the trot. So, yeah, there's definitely a reasoning for it.
And that year in the semis, you beat Martin Adams 5-2 with two big... you know, 140 plus checkouts to win the game. And I know you said in your post-match interview that you and Stephen had focused on beating Martin. Why was Martin such a difficult opponent for you? Or why was there such a mental block when you played him?
Well, it's very rare I beat Martin, to be honest. But I wasn't the only one. He was quality, you know what I mean? He's such a hard player to play. He's like a robot. And I think sometimes, I don't know, again, whether it's bottle or you just have a jinx. I always thought Merv King was my jinx, but I nailed that near the end of the career anyway. I beat him a couple of times. But that one win, even my wife Jill said, I've never seen you that focused for a darts match. I mean, there was a time where I think mine missed a ball for a 161. And I took the 170 out the next throw. And I think, I have watched it since, and Martin went to shake my hand as I was going back, and I totally ignored him. Now, I would never do that normally, but that just shows to me that I was focused. And I thought it was quite funny when I saw it later day, because so many people telling me, like, he totally blanked him. I thought, I don't remember it. So, so I think that... mental coaching side of it is definitely something for players to look at, I think. You know, if they feel they might need that, sometimes it's only 1% that can make the difference. So, I think there's a big future in that. And obviously, I know a lot of the PDC guys go that route as well, so it must work.
That final in 2012, you played Christian Kist, and again, sort of a slower start from you. You were 6-2 down before you pulled it right back to 6-5. When you started coming back, did you start to think again, you know, maybe this is for a reason, maybe, you know, this is going to be the time I do it? Or were you just thinking, you know, I've got to win this leg?
Well, I think that's exactly it. Once I was behind early on, I'm not a good starter anyway, never have been. And to be that far behind, it's just take one leg at a time. And then when you get the set again, it's just one leg at a time. I mean... I've probably not told many people this, and I've actually started writing a book, and it's going to be in the book. But the night before, my son and grandson were actually down visiting the Lakeside, and I'd found them somewhere to stay, and they were actually involved in a car accident right at the Lakeside. So I didn't go to bed till about 4 in the morning, because obviously it was they had to be taken to hospital. So I've not really told many people that, and I'm not saying that's an excuse, because I'm not a good sleeper the night before a big game anyway, but that was on my mind, and I didn't really sleep the night before. And sometimes I wonder if, you know, if that never happened, you never know. But anyway, so it's all done and dusted now, and I gave it my best shot and got it back, and I almost got the comeback in there. But he was a worthy champion, Christian. He was a great player and a great kid as well.
The next year, 2013, was your last final. Well, at least for now, anyway. And you lost 7-1 to Scott Waites. Was that one the biggest disappointment for you in terms of performance?
I've said before, I don't mind losing as long as it's a good game and then the crowd gets the money's worth. But I probably felt the most pressure I've ever felt there, because obviously I just didn't perform and I didn't really make Scott play like he can. I mean, it was a pretty poor final, to be honest. And I was probably apologising for that for 2 or 3 years. Everyone I met, I felt like getting my money out and giving them all their entry money back. It was pretty poor, to be honest. And that's probably one time in my whole life where, you know, I'd say that you know, that was shocking, and I just wasn't up to it. It was around that time where the diabetes was kicking in as well. Stephen McKibben was actually with me there, and he said he tried talking to me in the back room, and I really just wasn't on the ball with him, you know what I mean? So, again, it sounds like excuses, but none at all. He was a better player by a mile, and we're the champion.
And with the diabetes, how did that affect you, your career and your playing?
I've had it for, it's probably 2007 I started with it. It's type 2, obviously. It's lifestyle. I mean, everyone's got eyes, you know, I'm a big lad, and anyone who's been at an exhibition with me knows I like a pint and I enjoy myself, and it's totally self-inflicted. But obviously other players, I mean Raymond Barneveld's had it for a few years now, and it's affected him quite a few occasions, but he's now, he seems to have sorted his head out, and he's lost the weight, and he's controlling his diabetes better, and most of the time I feel okay. It's just now and again, especially when I've been on the road for a couple of months, which does happen in darts. You ask any player, it can be tiring, even if you're fully fit. And again, it's self-inflicted, so it's my bug to bear, and I should look after myself a bit better, really. But especially exhibitions, you're out there, people want to pint me, and like I say, I'm old school with Jockey and Eric, and I'm quite happy to stay late and have a few beers. So, but that's the way I chose to do it, and I'm quite happy.
And just quickly looking back at 2012, and you know, that your son and your grandson in the accident, you didn't, as far as I remember, you didn't mention that after the game. Did you just not want to talk about it, or was it a case of, you know, you didn't want to, you felt it might take the shine off Christian?
Exactly. I didn't want to use it as an excuse. Just like, I mean, this is why it's the first time I've mentioned it probably in an interview ever. And that's mainly because I'm started writing a book. Hopefully it'll be out in about 3 or 4 months. So that's going to be in there. But again, in the book, it's not an excuse. It's just something that I don't think it took my mind off the game. But you just never know. And I don't know. It's just one of them things that happens, and you get on with it, and it's not the end of the world. They weren't badly hurt. It was just more of a shock to the system. Mm. So, yeah, it's little things happen, and it's how you deal with it, isn't it? So I moved on from there, and still won other events. So.
You played at the Lakeside, I think it was 16 consecutive years before you missed it in 2018. After that, such a long run, what was it like actually not being involved with the playing side?
No, I hated it. I didn't really want to watch it. I was doing bits of commentary before that anyway, so I think I was asked to do the commentary, which I thought, well, I suppose it's the next best thing. So I went and did a bit of the commentary, but again, I've sort of been held back a little bit with other bits and bobs. I mean, that's when I started with the arthritis in my knee. I think I had a knee replacement the year after that. If I was a footballer, I think I'd have been long retired. I think you get away with it as a dart player, but things didn't go out of order, and obviously I want to carry on playing and me decide when. But obviously I missed the one just gone as well, the first one of the 0-2. So yeah, I missed a couple since then, and it hurt that after all them years of being a regular and having to miss it. So yeah, I'm obviously if things improve and we do start the tour again, and I mean I'm playing all right again as it happens at the moment. I played some good matches in the Remote Darts League, and hopefully my career's not finished for majors if we ever get back up and running.
Well, like I have to say, when you were on the commentary, I have to say you were a real refreshing addition for me, because you were kind of able to talk from experience as a player, but you also had some brilliant stories from your time on the exhibitions. I remember during one game you were talking about you and Daryl doing an exhibition in Scotland, and one of you got a big finish, jumped up, and then the stage kind of fell down.
Yeah, I remember it well. It was Daryl at a 9 dart at the end of the evening. I think he only had a couple more games to play. I remember thinking when he hit it, the stage collapsed, and I'm thinking, why did that happen early on? I wouldn't have had to play in my last match. But there was about 40 or 50 jumps on the stage, and that's when we found out that the stage had actually been built on beer crates. Yeah, but I mean, I think that's what, for me, my job in the commentary box is to bring once in a while a bit of humour to it and talk about your relationships with the players and what have you. I mean, your main commentator's there for the facts and the, you know, the technical stuff. I think you should always have somebody to bounce off, just have a bit of banter with and a bit of fun, and that's what I try and do. It doesn't always happen, obviously.
And you're also part of the commentary team for 2020 at the O2. How did the venues compare for you, the Lakeside and the O2?
That O2 is some place. I mean, it was awkward to get to. I mean, the thing is with the Lakeside, I know it's an old-fashioned and it needs upgrading, but the hotel's on the venue, and once you're there, you're in your own little cocoon, your own bubble, and you can relax and enjoy. Now, at the O2, I know there's people using trains once they got off the main train, so I know there was a lot of faff to actually get in the venue, but once you were in there, it was awesome. And the facilities were second to none. I can see, you know, the reason for going there in a way, but why would you leave, you know, for me, the best ever darts venue there's ever been? So, again, I'm using them words, old school. The Lakeside is definitely old school, the old Embassy days, and that. I'd take it back there tomorrow if I was in charge.
Well, talking about, you know, being in charge, obviously we've seen over the last month the real, you know, sort of end of the road for the BDO, and, you know, there was the whole liquidation stuff at the start of the month. I mean, was that sad for you when you saw about, you know, things sort of really going belly up, as it were?
Well, the real sad thing is we've all been seeing it coming for a few years, but no matter what we said or what input we gave, nobody ever listened to the players anyway. So we could see it coming 5-6 years ago, if we're honest. But again, the people that were in charge just didn't want to listen to the players, and unfortunately, I thought this was coming from a long time back. So, I mean, obviously, I know the WDF have been involved with our system for a long time, but they haven't had the hands-on day-to-day. Now I'm hoping that changes, and we hear that, you know, little Richard and one or two others who are now part of the WDF setup, they're on board, and I just hope that their knowledge and their influence and what have you, I just hope that that gets us up back flying, and let's do a world tour, and let's try and show that we can be professional and get all these tournaments back.
And, you know, moving forward, how much longer do you envisage you'll be playing, and what goals have you still got left as a player?
As I said, I've not been playing too bad just lately. I mean, I played quite a few good games at the remote league. I know it's easier stood in your own lounge with no shoes and socks on played. I made sure I was comfortable. But obviously, when the tour starts, that'll be the test to see how everyone's playing. And I still want to play at World Championships. And I think on my day I can still beat anybody. So until we're up and running again, never know. But long term, I'd love to be, you know, still getting phone calls to do exhibitions in another 10 years' time, maybe. I know John Lowe and Bob Anderson and a few of the other older boys are still quite busy in the exhibition circuit. So I'd still like to be doing things like that in the future. I'd say that's all I've known, really, for 35 years is darts. And yeah, it'd be sad to leave it behind totally.
What was it that motivated you to start writing your book?
People, when they do read it, I mean, a lot of people know that I actually started in darts when I was only like 21 years of age. I worked for Alan Evans, who lived in Stockport, and I worked with him for probably 10 years on the exhibition circuit. So I travelled, I saw Jockey a lot, I saw a lot of Bristow, you know, the older players, obviously being with Alan sort of day to day. Then I ended up working for him other reasons, and like I said, I've got a lot of stories to tell, and some funny, some not so funny. Obviously, I just thought I've had quite a busy life, and I just thought that's just something I've always fancied doing. And like I said, there's one thing in there I really wanted to put straight, a lot of rumours and things about, and there's one thing in there I'll be putting straight and, you know, putting the story out there. But a lot of it's funny, and a lot of it's football related as well, so it's a bit of everything in it. And well, I think everyone should write a book when they get to a certain age, and I'm 60 next, so I think that's the certain age.
looking back, to put you on the spot, what would be your main career highlight?
Obviously, the 9 data was special, but definitely winning the WDF World Cup singles, playing for England. I mean, again, it's my one and only major, but there wasn't even any prize money for it, do you know what I mean? But I would still have that down as my glory moment. And as I say, I've got a nice picture of it on my wall here with my gold medal and for winning the singles. And so there was no money, but there was millions of pounds of memories in that. So, that'd be the one for me.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this afternoon, Tony. You're one of the game's great modern characters and always one of my favourites to watch. So it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Andrew. Lovely to speak to you, my friend.